This episode is brought to you by Set for Life Insurance. Listen, docs, one of the first steps we took to pay off our student loan debt was realizing we paid way too much for our disability insurance. That all changed when we found Set for Life Insurance. They helped us with a customized insurance policy that met our needs and, most of all, budget. To learn more, check out setforlifeinsurance.com.
If you don't want your plumber giving you medical advice, then why are you negotiating your job contract by yourself? Listen, higher salaries and reasonable call hours, these are all at stake here. So why don't you use the folks at Resolve to get your contract reviewed and negotiated? Resolve uses market data for your specialty and location to get what you deserve. Resolve also helps you search new job opportunities. Use the offer code DOB10 for 10% off any of their affordable services. Check them out at resolve.com. What's good, everyone? This is Dr. Nee. Yo, thank you for tuning in. I'm really excited about this episode. I think that after listening to this, you're going to be changed. I feel really confident about this episode, and I feel really confident about this guest. So let's jump right into it. Listen, whether you are in medical school, all the things that you go through during that time, as well as through residency, all of that really is, the way how I look at it, is really conditioning you, preparing you to be an independently, fully functioning doctor, able to deal with patients in your specialty, taking care of a whole bunch of different, you know, medical conditions. And, you know, whether it's the long hours, whether it's the late nights, whether it's the overnights, whether it's the dealing with multiple personalities, whether it's from your attendings or from your co-residents, there's a lot of preparation that's involved in that, right? Even in medical school, there's the long nights, the quizzes, you're getting tested every couple of weeks. There's a lot of stress that's involved in there, all to make you a really fully independently functioning doctor. But the one thing that I think we don't get prepared for is understanding the psyche of patients, particularly patients when they are not following instructions, I guess, so to speak, what's the best way to describe it? Or we use the term, quote unquote, non-compliant. I know that's out of vogue right now, but you know what I'm talking about. If they're not following directions, what's the psyche there, right? Because oftentimes we try to scare them. That doesn't work. You may lose this. You may have this situation happen to you. But yet their behavior doesn't change. So my next guest, his name is Dr. Jamal Dixon. He knows what it's like to reach the goal of graduating from medical school, the goal of getting into your dream residency that you've always wanted, making it almost to the end of residency, and then being diagnosed with stomach cancer. That's right. I said that, stomach cancer. He literally went from being chief resident to being a patient in literally a short period of time. We're talking about a week. He ended up undergoing two long surgeries, experienced some significant surgical setbacks that you'll hear about in this conversation. But more importantly, you're going to hear about how he's experienced medicine from the side that very few of us get to encounter, the side that I think most of us hope not to ever encounter, which is that of being a patient. He's also going to talk about what it's like to understand complications that could occur from his own behavior and to really not give a shit about that. Really, seriously. It's really an interesting take, an interesting view into a mindset of someone who understands all of the consequences but is willing to take some risk. So listen, I heard Dr. Jamal speak on the Black Doctors podcast, which is a great podcast out there, but I knew I needed to get him on this show so that we can discuss his journey, as well as talk about that transformation, how he's been able to rise from that, and now he's using his experiences to help other people, particularly providing counseling services for caregivers, and then doubling down on that and focusing on caregivers as well as those who are suffering from medical PTSD. He has a creation that's called the Caregiver Sanctuary. You can learn more about that by going into the show notes. And listen, after listening to this episode, like I said earlier, you're going to be changed by this. In my experience, what he's going to be talking about, Dr. Jamal, I think what he says and how he talks, that needs to be must read, must listen for every medical student, every resident in the country. And if anyone is listening and you're affiliated with a medical school, if you're affiliated with a residency program, you need to be reaching out to this guy right now and inviting him to talk to your program. All right. So listen, without further ado, I present Dr. Jamal Dixon. Let's get it. What's good, everyone? This is Dr. Nee with Docs Outside the Box. I got a special guest. through Zoom. Normally I would say special guests in a building, but we ain't talking about no physical buildings. We got Dr. Jamal Dixon. What's good, man? Welcome to Docs Outside the Box.
Hey, appreciate you. Appreciate you. How are you doing today, man?
I'm good. I'm good. So listen, let's get straight to the point. So listen, I heard you on the Black Doctors podcast with Stephen Bradley, Dr. Stephen Bradley, and your story is literally the reason why I kiss my kids every night or right before I leave for work. And I'm gonna put the audience on edge, and we're gonna put them on edge because your story is like that. And then I reached out to, I guess we have a common buddy, a common friend, Dr. Italo Brown, you know, the amazing Dr. Italo Brown, who's over at Stanford. You guys knew each other since medical school, I'm assuming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Medical school.
That's medical school, yeah.
And then he put me in touch with you. And you here now. So listen, let's I'm gonna ask you some questions, and I kind of want you to tell this story through these questions real quick. So why did you want to be a doctor?
So originally I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to engage in something where I could really solve problems. I can really help people. I can make some kind of impact with people. And, you know, growing up in Atlanta, Georgia, around that time, I was born in 86. We didn't really see a lot of doctors that looked like us. Like every doctor I'd seen, you know, white man, you know, and that's not that that's a bad thing in the totality, but we needed representation. You know, we needed to see people like us in those fields. So I really just wanted to get involved in something, you know, scientific, something that you had to plan and try to figure out like a puzzle, and you can interact and make an impact on people. And that led me to medicine. It was science. It was cool. Human body. That was pretty much it.
Okay. All right. So I'm assuming the way to get into medical school for you was easy, difficult. Tell us how it was.
So it was, I would say it had its challenges until I learned how to work smart. Okay. You know, as Black people, we're taught to work hard. You got to work harder than everybody else. Two times harder than everybody else. Hard work. That's what we've been led to believe. And we're not given the gift of just work smart and it'll work out the same. We're not encouraged to do that. So I went to undergrad at the University of Georgia. I thought I had to take some really super scientific major. I did biochemistry. I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but it sounded good. You know, biochemistry, biomedical
science. Let me guess,
science.
your first year, you taking like 16 or 18 credits?
Yeah.
Because everybody else did.
I was taking those. And then I was looking at the courses that were to come. And at the time we had, it was like Course Correct, or it was a site where you could rate the professors. And so when I looked at the classes ahead, like in the years to come, the students were like, yeah, they only give out 5% A's, 8% A's, and there are 200 people in the class. And I'm like, wow, that's going to take my GPA. Like, you know, that's really challenging. And I'm already dealing with, you know, chemistry one, chemistry two, differential equations, organic chem. And I'm like, wow, I got to go even harder for these classes. And so I met with my counselor, and my counselor told me, hey, if you're trying to get into med school, you really just need the prerequisite courses. Do well in those. You can take something else.
Yeah.
And then just do well in that, finish that out. As long as your prereqs are good and your MCATs are good, you'll get in. And so after that,
that's some good advice. That is some good advice right there.
And that's something we don't know. We think I have to do physics. I have to do organic. You can change your major, anything else. I did psychology and it was easy. The math there was easy. I had a math course where you could use a graphing calculator, ace it, like, you know,
a TI-85.
Yeah. We can take advantage of these things too. But we're made to feel guilty for taking advantage of the system.
Gotcha.
Why?
Gotcha.
So work smart, not hard. You can take another major, just do well on your prereqs. And even if you take another major, now you have a conversation piece when it comes to the interviews.
Yo, let me tell you something right now. On real, like when I started going to, when I once I got into medical school, so mm-hmm. I applied to medical school twice. And the second time I came in angry. I was like, man, I got a chip on my shoulder. I can't believe I'm going to be older than everybody else, which is actually not true, right?
Yeah.
The majority of people probably in medical school are kind of getting close to more non-traditional students than traditional students. But like I was shocked how many people were doing other majors or did other majors. And yeah. I was low key kind of jealous, right? You know what I'm saying? Cause I didn't like, I only got hip to the game that you could have just done your prerequisites late into getting my biology degree, you know? So you hip on game early. I like it. Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. So when you hit that, if you do another major, now you have a conversation piece. Well, you did your prereqs. Why did you take this math major? Why did you do liberal arts? Why did you do whatever? Now you have something that makes you stand out when you apply. Because if you still do well in your prereqs, that's really all they care about in the end. Did you take these well? Did you score well in the MCAT? You have a story that is going to make me pick your application out of these hundreds that I'm tired of reading through all the time. That makes you go. So learning that was like a miracle because I didn't want to take plant biology. I didn't want to take advanced virus and all these other kinds of courses.
Right.
And these are things you don't have to do. You know, even as a minority, there are a lot of things we don't have to do to make it, but we're told to do it because that's just what it used to be. And we're not taught ways to circumvent the system in a smart way. And everybody else is doing it. We should be able to cash in on the same things. So that's kind of my philosophy on that. So I have my challenges in the prereqs early. Organic chem too, you know, everyone, no one likes it, you know. But outside of that, once I learned how to work a little bit smarter to get to med school, it was a lot better.
Okay. All right. So how many schools you got into?
So here's the thing. All you need is one, right? So for me, I applied within the Southern region. So I got interviews at MCG.
There's not many schools in the Southern region.
Yeah, I know. But I wanted to stay in the South. So I got one at Meharry, MCG Augusta, MCG Athens was opening up at the time. Mm-hmm. So I got one there. I sent one to Morehouse, got rejected. So I ended up with a total of three.
And don't feel bad. I mean, Morehouse is straight up like, what is Morehouse the hardest school to get into, right, in the country?
Yeah, I think it was definitely the hardest of those three.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't even surprised at that one.
So you got into three
and then got waitlisted on all three and then got into Meharry.
Okay.
And so, Meharry was the one where I felt I had the worst interview.
Okay. So you get into Meharry. You feel like you're on top of the world, right?
I feel great.
I feel like you're the man.
I don't know about the man. I was just happy to be there, man. To be honest with you, I was just happy to start my new journey in med school. You feel that sense of pride, though. Oh, I'm going to be a doctor now. Like I'm arrived at this new school. I'm in Nashville. You know, it's a new start. I'm feeling great, you know, and we started in the summer. So we got there June 25th. That was the first day we started 2010. So I'm feeling great.
Come on, dude. The fact that you remember the date, that was like, that's the highlight of your life at that moment. One of the highlights of your life. Hey, doc, you're probably not going to hire someone to help you negotiate your next job offer because you're afraid of how much it will cost. But listen, it could cost you much more in the long run. You don't get what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. And that's real talk. And if you don't negotiate, you'll be leaving a lot on the table. I'm talking about a higher salary, better benefits, more reasonable call hours. Resolve helps doctors review and negotiate job contracts so that you get what you deserve. They'll review and negotiate your contract using market data for your specialty and location. With Resolve on your team, you'll realize that nearly everything in your contract is negotiable. Resolve also helps with your job search, including CV review, interview coaching, and so much more. Oh, did I mention that it's also affordable? So listen, get off that fence, go to resolve.com, and make sure you use the offer code DOB10 for 10% off any of their services.
Oh, no, definitely the highlight. I remember that day because it was hot, man. We was outside. We got laptops. And, you know, we were just professionally, and I wasn't expecting Nashville to be that hot. So, yeah, I remember all of that. Mm. Just the pride, the happiness, being the first one in your family to get that far. Like, you carry that sense of pride with you, of course.
So you were the first one in your family to get into medical school?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let's fast forward.
Yeah.
When did you decide you wanted to do internal medicine?
Oh, I learned that early. That was that didn't take long. The advice I would give to people out there, when you start your third year rotations, you'll know. It'll come to you really quick. Second year, though, is kind of when I knew, because I already knew for OB-GYN, that was my first rotation.
Hey, guys, this is Dr. Nee. Listen, I hope you all are enjoying this conversation. But listen, I'm going to cut through a portion of it just for expediency's sake. But what I'm trying to set the stage for is Dr. Jamal feels like he's on top of the world. Imagine you are studying something that less than 1% of the population studies, knows, or practices. You're young, so you feel invincible. And we continue the conversation where we're talking about him deciding on internal medicine. After doing multiple rotations, he decides that he wants to do internal medicine as a specialty. He goes through the match and he actually doesn't match, which is disappointing, has to take a year off, and decides to match the second time. But Dr. Jamal doesn't just do it the regular way. He decides to do what's called the suicide match, which I didn't know really much about before until he told me about this. But the suicide match is where you've applied to multiple programs, you've gotten multiple interviews, but because there's this one place that you really want to go to, he cancels all of his other interviews and takes a chance on a flyer, which is, at this point, he really wants to be at Morehouse School of Medicine down in Atlanta, Georgia. So this is on his second try for the match in internal medicine. And you know what? He finally gets in. He gets into Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. Full disclosure, that's where I did my residency. And he's doing great. He makes it all the way to his third year, his final year, the year where he can see the horizon, the year where he starts to make decisions on where he wants to practice full time on his own, contracts, all of those things that you get so hyped up about. He's there. But listen, before I tell you what happens next, or before we jump into what happens next, I want to know, how many of you all in medical school right now are studying some type of disease process? And you might be happening to you as a resident. Either you're studying some type of disease process or you're taking care of something and you get the notion that maybe you're going through that process. That happened to me when I was in medical school, and for the first time I was learning about diabetes. I got really skinny legs, low key, and I don't really have much hair on my legs. And I remember one of the symptoms of diabetes is kind of having hair sparsely go down your leg. And I thought in my mind, oh, I got diabetes. That's why I don't have, you know, really hairy legs and so forth. And obviously, it's something that I got in my mind and it went through, right? You start going through the nuances of diabetes and realize, I don't have this, right? But what if this were you? You were going through something, you're studying something, you're realizing something, and you're like, whoa, I'm starting to feel a certain type of way physically, and it's not going away. So let's jump back into this conversation. But before we get there, we're going to jump into it where Dr. Jamal feels like he's doing great, but he starts to feel physically a certain way. He has certain symptoms, and he feels like it may be in his head, but something is not going right. Let's jump right into it.
Well, at the time, it was DeKalb Medical, and I'm doing a hospitalist rotation there. And all of a sudden, I just started feeling like a lot of gas. I was having a lot of gas coming up. And then I remember I was trying to eat a Chipotle burrito and I could only get through like a fourth of it and I was full. I was just like, that ain't normal. Like usually I can eat like three of these. Like what's going on? Push it away. It gets worse. So now it's like, oh, this is really early satiety right here. Like I could have like a smoothie, maybe cup like this big, drink like maybe that much. I'm full.
Really?
And I was like, whoa, this... something's wrong here. Like that's never happened before.
This is all in the same month of August, or this is over time?
All in the same month.
Okay.
Same month. And I remember it because I used to always go to Chipotle, then I'd go hit up Jamba Juice, get a smoothie. And then I would just get full like that. And as a doctor, oh, that's early satiety. Like I can't push that thought out of my head. And as you know, early satiety means you get full quickly, right? Mm-hmm. So if you get full quickly, there's only a couple of things that can really cause that. None of them are really good. So already in my mind, I'm like, it's weird. This is coming out of nowhere. It can only be a couple of things. I'm going to have to get this checked out. Like, I can't avoid it because it's not going away. You know, if it had been just a one-time thing, oh, maybe I had gas.
Any pain or anything like that?
No pain.
You didn't lose weight?
No weight loss, no changes in bowel habits, no blood in my stool, none of that.
You ain't tried, like, there's no denial at this point? Because, you know, people go through denial. Man, I know I got it early satiety, but okay.
I denied it, but then it kept happening. Like, okay. Day after day, it kept happening to where I couldn't deny it anymore because I literally couldn't eat as much.
Ooh, so, okay, now we get into it. Okay, you can eat. Okay, so that's a big issue.
Yeah, so I'm barely able to eat. And this is happening rapidly within a two-week period. So this was like mid-August. And then it's like, this is happening like day after day after day after day. I'm eating less and less. And I'm getting full really quickly. And then I have a little distension, but I felt, you know, because I was eating a lot during the summer. You know, maybe I just put on some weight. Because, you know, I was in the gym still. I'm still able to do regular workouts. I'm able to do the treadmill as much. I'm lifting the same thing. Like, I'm thinking I'm fine. Bowel movements regular. I'm thinking I'm, I don't know what this is.
And how old are you?
At this time, 31.
Are you 31? That's the other thing. You're young. You still 31. A kid.
Yeah.
So how bad could it be? That's probably what you know, at least that's what I'd be thinking. Like, I'm 31. Come on, yo. Like, you know?
You know what I thought it was, what I tried to tell myself it was? At the time, I had sleep apnea, right? I'd already did the test, had a CPAP machine. And, you know, I was using it nightly. And,
you thought your stomach was getting full of gas.
Yeah, I looked it up. I was like, ooh, aerophagia. That's what it is. I'm just eating all this air at night. That's why I'm just feeling like that. And the air got to leave. Like, I tried to convince myself that it had to be that. It couldn't be cancer. It couldn't be an ulcer. It couldn't be anything else because I'm young. I don't have anything else going on.
Right.
It's not in my family. Can't be. Right? Okay.
All right.
So the problem was it kept happening. And so I said, well, I have vacation in September, Labor Day, starting Labor Day weekend. I'm just going to get a CT. We're just going to get to the bottom of it. Can't deny it. I need to know. I need to have peace of mind. So I remember my Lounge Brothers bachelor day party was September 2nd. So we were there reading the Bible, you know, engaging in fellowship. And then after that, I remember I walked in on September 3rd. I went to Piedmont, Midtown. So it was in the evening. Walked in, told him my symptoms, said, hey, I need a CT. Like, I'm a third-year medical resident. Like, I'm using all my doctor credentials. Right. You know, like, hey, professional courtesy, let's just cut to the chase. Like, early satiety, I need a CT. Let's figure this out. Like, we can skip all this other stuff that y'all going to ask me. I already know what we have to do. We get the CT. ED doctor comes in. He has that I have bad news face. I'd seen that face before. I've had it. So when he came in with that face, and it was just like, that's how he came in. And I was like, ooh, it might be cancer for real. Like, that's what I'm thinking in my head. Like, it might be for real. He wouldn't make that face unless something was wrong. And he comes in, he's like, yo, I don't know how, you know, it got this big, but you have this really large tumor in there. We can't identify it, but you're going to need surgery. And I was like, how big is it? Show me. Like, I got to see it. And so he turns around the monitor. I'm looking at the CT scan. I was like, oh, like, that's massive. And if you check out my profile on Instagram, I have it there. You probably seen it. Like, it's a massive.
That's a big boy.
It was like a baby inside my abdomen. And I was just like, how did that happen without me knowing? Like, I didn't have any symptom that should be present for how big it was and the organs it was pressing against. It was nothing. How is this possible? So when I first heard it, you know, that feeling, it's numb. You just feel numb and you're just wondering, how could this happen to me? And I'm young. Mm-hmm. And this is not a genetic thing. My family doesn't. How did this happen? How did we get here to this point? I was at the top of my life. I was the healthiest I thought I was. Like, most successful.
That's why I asked the question this way. That's why I asked the questions this way.
I'm at the top. Like all those other times were great. This was the top of the top. You couldn't get no higher than this.
Mm-hmm.
And now it was just like, you know, what's the rest of my life going to look like? Like, what are we going to, how do we get past it? And then it just came up to, well, first things first, we got to get a surgery. Like, there's no getting around it.
So you got admitted. All right, guys, this is Dr. Nee again. Listen, we're going to jump and fast forward again for expediency's sake. But listen, I want you guys to really focus on the mindset. It goes from being a provider, a physician, to next becoming a patient. And the decisions that we oftentimes excoriate our patients for, it's amazing how just like that, we quickly go into patient mode and we make certain decisions that, you know, we kind of think about are as questionable. So we're going to jump into him making a decision with surgery and then deciding not to tell his parents to the last minute. Let's jump right into it.
You know, I had to tell my program, I had to tell my chief, you know, I told some of my friends there, and you know, it was different knowing that, hey, I have to have the surgery. But then I started realizing, how do I tell my parents? I don't really know how to break this down of saying, hey, I have cancer. I have to have the surgery. I might not make it through this. I didn't know how to tell my mom that. And she'd been a registered nurse for 32 years. So there's no sugarcoating it. There was no dancing around it. There's really no way I knew of how to tell her. So I hid it from her. I hid it from her until the night before surgery.
Oh my goodness.
That's when I told her.
Why? So, why? Oh my goodness.
So here's one of the things that happens, you know, when you're a patient, right?
Oh, and I know how much of a hard head you go. Oh, you are the hardest, the hardest head, yo. Oh my God, from a surgical, but we're going to get to that part later on. Let's just keep going. My bad, yo. My bad, everyone.
Yeah.
When I heard this story, I was like, I can't believe this guy did this, but keep going.
Yeah. Hey, man, look. So here's how it goes, right? And I had to learn these lessons the hard way.
Oh, yeah, you did. Oh, yeah, you did.
Yeah. As a patient, when we know we have a disease and we know the people around us would be hurt by it, we try to protect the people we love. Now, the execution is poor. Right? Very poor. It can be done the wrong way. But in my mind at the time, I thought, hey, I just found out on third. If I can just wait until the night before, I will have saved my mom 10 days of crying about it, getting upset about it.
I get it.
And if I tell her at the last minute, she won't have time to cry because we got to go.
But you know what, though? That jives with how you think, though. It seems like you just are very, you think efficiently. You think about efficiency.
Yeah.
You think about, you know, you don't like, I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. So you didn't tell it to the night before. So.
Yeah. At the time, like, my girlfriend at the time, she was like, yo, you got to tell her. I was like, there's no way I'm telling her before that day. I don't know how to tell her. I'm not trying to see her cry. We just going to wait till the night before. She ain't gonna have time to worry about it. Like no one could convince me that I was doing the wrong thing at the time, because now I'm in the protect the people around me from pain mindset that we have as patients. And that's why a lot of times patients wait until the end to tell their family, hey, I have this, or hey, I'm actually dying, but I didn't want you guys to know and feel sad the whole time. I wanted us to be as happy as possible.
Gotcha.
So it's a bad coping mechanism that we develop when we become a patient, right? And that's what it was for me, you know, looking back at it. And I really thought I was right. Like no one could convince me I was wrong in keeping this from her. And I saw her every day. All those 10 days, I saw her every day. Said nothing. And I thought I was right.
So what happened when you told her?
Oh, she was mad. you know, she was mad. The first question, why didn't you tell me earlier? Because you know, she was like, when did you find out? September 3rd. Why didn't you tell me before? Well, and then I had to give her the same explanation. Mm-hmm. And she was like, no, you should have said it. We could have
prepared
this, that, and this and that. And I was like, hey, we don't have time for that. You know, I got to get to the hospital now. I got to take this go lightly. We got to get all this out so we can be ready for surgery tomorrow. We got to go. And that was it. And so, I thought I was right.
So let's fast forward a little bit. So you get to surgery Mm-hmm. You get your surgery. Mm-hmm. Tell me what happens post-op.
So after the first surgery, I remember coming out. They extubated me, cool. And he sat me up. He told me what happened during the surgery. So it was 9 hours.
Damn! 9 hours.
9 hours. The tumor had grown from the outside of my stomach, and that's where it started. But then it started growing inside the stomach itself towards the back. And then that's when it closed off the rest of the stomach. And that's when I started having the early satiety, right? So if you're looking at it, it's growing out from the front here. It starts going backwards here, closes off the rest of the stomach, right? Because of that, he had to remove 60% of my stomach. So basically became a bariatric patient off of that. Mm-hmm. Because it had pressed against my large colon and pushed it into my pelvis, he had to remove the transverse colon because he couldn't clarify clear margins on the transverse colon, right? So there was no way for him to know whether all the cells had been removed of the tumor from there. And if you don't, hey, that's a risk of colon cancer. Can't have that transverse colon gone, right? So basically, he gave me a Bill Roth II surgery. So I'm pretty sure you know what that is.
I'm sure when he was telling you that he removed your transverse colon, you were looking at your belly like, I hope this guy didn't give me an ostomy. I hope he didn't give me an ostomy.
Oh, no. I knew it wasn't an ostomy because I was awake by the time he came back.
So all right, cool.
I just seen the large scar here and then some tubes sticking out down here. So I was like, before he came in, I was like, oh, they must just took the, you know, just took the tumor out. I'm good. Mm-hmm. And then he came in with, nah, man, look, 6% of your stomach gone, 30 of your colon's gone. And then we had to reattach some things. But so that's when I realized, yo, my life's not going to be the same. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, I'm really here now. This is really different, you know. And when you're under, you don't know how long you're under. So I didn't even know it was 9 hours until he came in and said it. So I was like, oh, it must have really been serious. And I stay in 7 days. I'm discharged the day before my birthday on the 20th. I go home. Day four, I'm feeling really just weak. I'm pale, even more pale. I'm breathing fast. I take my temperature, 102.4. So I'm like, oh, I'm septic now. Great.
You literally think in your mind you're septic. Like, that's what you said in your mind. I'm septic.
Yeah.
Man, you just self-diagnosing like crazy.
My doctor mind is still going. I can't. Mm-hmm. I couldn't turn it off because it was like, I got to monitor and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. Once I saw that 102.4, I was like, oh, I'm septic now. So
you see anything draining from your wound or anything like that? Or
yes. And at first, I didn't know what it was. It was just like a bunch of green stuff coming out where the duodenum was. So, you know, I didn't think much of it.
Oh, wait. And he gave you a Bill Roth too.
Bill Roth too.
So and you got green stuff coming
out of the stomach to the duodenum.
So if everybody knows, basically the stomach gets connected to your small bowel and mm-hmm. whatever is left of your, basically the second portion of your duodenum, even the first portion of your duodenum, there's a stump there. There's a staple line there. So when mm-hmm. you say drain, he left the drain right next to your stump?
No. See, that was the thing. There was no drain there.
And but you said green stuff is coming out.
There was a wound that was a little bit lower where they had a drainage towards the lower abdomen, right? So there was fluid draining from that area, but there was no decompression to where the duodenum was supposed to be, right? So you already know what happened there, right?
Yeah.
That's why you're making that face, right?
The worst thing that you want to happen, yeah.
I didn't know. I just knew.
So you had a duodenal, blowout.
Duodenal rupture. Yeah. So when I saw it, I was saying, oh, I'm septic here. I gotta go to the hospital. Call 911. They come get me. They take me back.
Hey guys, Dr. Nee here again. Listen, what's going on with Dr. Jamal is he's describing a dreaded complication that we as general surgeons hate to even think about. And it's something that's called a duodenal blowout. Basically, he's leaking intestinal contents into his abdomen and he needs immediate surgery. So he ends up calling 911, gets taken to the operating room immediately, and they find what they find. And He has this huge intra-abdominal infection for which he needs antibiotics for a significant period of time. Well, not only that, but post-op, he develops fluid around his lungs. This can usually be taken care of by a bedside procedure or a procedure in an interventional radiology suite called a thoracentesis. But what if the fluid gets so thick? If it gets so thick, you can't just drain it out on a bedside procedure. You need something that's called video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, where they put cameras in your chest and they drain and even take some of that thick fluid out. Now, we're going to jump into why it's important to advocate for yourself, particularly now we're at the point where he's developing kidney failure. I know you guys are like, man, it can't get any worse. Oh, it gets worse. Let's jump right into it.
And the rest of it was waiting on my kidneys to get better from a numbers perspective. Mm-hmm. And this is where advocating for comes into play.
Let's talk about this. Let's talk about being your best, the best person who's going to take care of yourself. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So as you know, they say medical staff, physicians especially, are the worst patients. I like to challenge that. I don't think we're the worst. I think that we know what should happen. We know what to expect. And I'm going to call you on. So if you don't advocate for yourself, you know, because human errors happen, oversights might happen. You always want to make sure you know fully what's going on as a patient, regardless of your education status, regardless of what job you work, who you are, skin color, gender, whatever. You have to advocate for yourself and make sure you know 100% what's going on. So I remember when I got out of the third surgery, they wanted to do temporary dialysis on me because of my labs, and they were scared of kidney failure because the creatinine went from 0.8 to 5.4, all these other things, right?
But you were still peeing though, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
I'm filling jugs up. Every hour and a half, I'm peeing more than 0.5 per hour. Like, one, I was peeing. Two, you just gave me my chemistry labs, my electrolytes are normal.
Right, so now we're back in your wheelhouse now. So you definitely know what you're talking about.
This is internal medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is internal medicine now. Mm-hmm. So you can't tell me, even though you're a nephrologist, and this goes to show, even if they're a specialist, you can still advocate for yourself. Because he's telling me, well, your creatinine's up here. It's looking high. It's looking like kidney failure. And I'm telling you, I'm peeing the entire time, a whole lot. My electrolytes are normal, serum chemistry. Urine chemistry, my electrolytes are normal. What are you doing dialysis for? What toxins are you getting rid of? I don't have them.
So your BUN is normal?
BUN is normal.
Yeah. Man,
the only thing abnormal was the creatinine. And there were many reasons for that.
AEIOU, and you're not filling any of the AEIOUs. Yeah.
I had a bunch of volume loss because I had two blood transfusions right after the surgery. So volume loss, infection, sounds like AKI to me. What are we doing this for? I don't have a high potassium. What are you taking out? No. So I followed my reviews. I was like, I'm not getting no port. You're not doing anything because I'm peeing still. When I stop peeing, I'll let you know. And that was it.
That was ballsy, but that was what's up. That's what you're supposed to do.
But that was it. You had me hooked up to a monitor. I wasn't going to any kind of arrhythmias. Like, I'll let you know. We get in chemistry labs every day. I'll let you know.
I love it.
So advocate for yourself as a patient. If you are the patient, ask for your records.
So
give them to you.
So let me ask you a question. So did your creatinine start to correct on its own?
Yeah, just like I told him.
How long did it take you before you started peeing, or before your creatinine came back to normal?
Took about a month.
So you was in the hospital for a month?
If you start from September, a little over, it was almost 2 months.
2 months. Oh my goodness.
About two
months. All right. So let's get to the part where let's talk about eating.
Yeah. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
When I heard
you describe this, I was about to come out through and I was like, Dr. Dixon, yo, I got to get you, yo, but let's talk about this, yo, please. So you're basically a bariatric patient now. Let's talk about this.
So here's the thing, and all surgeons listening, you will probably be just as upset because you know what happens. So
And we just, and we already letting it known that you already had a major complication from your first Bill Roth surgery. So you had a duodenal blowout, which is the nightmare that general surgeons, we just don't want to have that. Okay. So I just preface it like that. So let's jump into this story. Tell us what happens.
This is after surgery two, right? So what they tell you when you're a bariatric patient, when you do the surgery, the sleeve, whatever it may be, they tell you you have to separate what you eat and what you drink about 30 minutes to an hour, right? I didn't want to believe that. I looked it up. Oh, it does say that.
Okay, cool. So now you know. It's in there.
So I know it's accurate. Here's the problem. I just got off NPO, and NPO is terrible. Yeah. Look, NPO is awful. So I'm off NPO. I'm ready to eat. And here's the thing where the patient mindset comes into understanding what it's like and the mental changes that take place as a patient. So for me, because of everything that happened, there's this sense of trying to return to normalcy that you have as a patient and you'll fight for. Whether it makes sense or not, you're going to fight to try to make life as normal as possible.
I never heard it described that way before. Change. I've never heard it described that way before. That's what's up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because if you accept the change, you accept that all the bad things that just happened are here to stay. And at that time, I wasn't ready to accept that. I wasn't ready to accept, hey, I have to eat different. No. The way I'm feeling, I want to feel good again. I want to feel like I'm a normal person, like this never happened. Okay. So I'm going to eat like nothing ever happened.
And just like I'm Will Smith and you, Jada. Yeah. What did you do, Dr. Jamal? What did you do? Like we had the red table talk. What did you do, Dr. Jamal?
So here's what I did, right? So they told me
you like
not
that?
To
you
do
like
that?
That.
Yeah. So they told me not to do that. And
what did you do, Dr. Jamal?
My family heard it. And you know what? So I was like, nah, fuck that. I'm just going to eat everything at the same time. I don't care.
And before we say, what did you eat, Dr. Jamal?
So a couple of things, right? So I remember a couple of the first meals. I had a smoothie for sure.
Because I know the hospital has a cafeteria, but you just keep going.
Well, yeah, but the hospital food was nasty. So I Uber eat it, to be honest with you. Uber eat it. This is real. I don't have to make this up. I Uber eat it. And there's this place called Sweet Hut. And, you know, they have some really good milk teas, bubble teas. So,
you didn't want the cafeteria food?
No.
So you ordered Uber Eats.
I Uber Eat it. And you know, Midtown, you right down the street from everything. So I ordered that. I get a wrap, you know, Caesar chicken wrap. You know, I've been waiting for that. Like, you know. So I start to eat.
I wish the audience could see my face, yo.
Start to eat and I start to drink. And I'm feeling good in the beginning. Cause you know. They tell you about, okay, dumping syndrome, enteral feeding syndrome, all these things that can happen after surgeries like that. And I know the pathophysiology of all that. And I still said, fuck that. I'm just going to eat like I want to eat. I don't even care. I know what could happen. But since I already been through so many bad things, I was like, man, I'm not even scared of this. Like, you can't scare me with these different types of feeding syndromes after dealing with surgical complications and infections and waking up during a CT drainage. Like, I was like, you can't really scare me with this no more. Like, that'd just be another list of things that happened.
So you're not scared. You're not scared of the complications anymore.
I'm not scared of that. Right. Yeah. And that's the thing we're not taught as physicians, that the resistance or noncompliance isn't from ignorance all the time. I can tell you the dynamics of how it happens. I can tell you how enteral feeding, dumping all this. I can tell you that. I can tell you that back then. I didn't care still. So it's not ignorance of medical knowledge all the time. Sometimes it's an emotional, it's a mental thing of, I just want to feel normal. I want to do something that makes me feel good. And that small moment of feeling good is worth whatever happens after. And I was willing to take that. So when it happened, I start getting dizzy. Heart starts beating out of my chest. I'm sweating everywhere, all over the place. heart rate running up. I'm nauseated. I'm slumped over in bed. Last for about 15 minutes. Nurse comes in when it starts to like tail off, like, you know, because all the sugar, all of that I ate at the same time, stretching everything out, you know, stretching out all the soup that you had in there and getting to the duodenum quicker than ever before. Like, I felt the full brunt of it, right? And she goes, well, how do you feel now? Now that, you know, you went through that, you experienced it, they told you it was going to happen, it happened. How do you feel now that it happened? And I looked at her and I was like, you know what? It was worth it. And I'll do it again. And that's what I said.
Okay.
And that's when it clicked about why people aren't always compliant, because we want that feeling of feeling good and normalcy so bad. I'll take what comes with it. That 5 minutes of joy was worth every minute of pain and discomfort that came after it at the time. Mm. It was worth it because I've been through so much bad. I felt I needed that. And I was willing to risk that to feel good. And that was what they were battling. It wasn't ignorance. It was a trauma response that you're dealing with, right? And that's what they were going against. So, you know, and there were times I did it again. It happened again. And then, you know, it stopped happening.
So, and then after this point, did you have any complications, like surgical complications after this point? Or that was it? You were in the clear?
No, that was it after that. After the third surgery, I didn't have any more complications after that. From that stay, no, that was it.
How long did it take you to get back to being a resident?
Starting from September, 6 months.
What was that first day like back?
Ooh, it was weird because a lot of the program didn't know the full extent of what happened. And they hadn't seen me in so long and I lost so much weight. So I was just starting to get new clothes because none of them fit. Because when I went in, I was 205. The smallest I got before discharge was 135. I was 141 when I left.
How tall are you?
5'7".
Damn!
So I lost like 8 pant sizes, suit sizes, just from that
Yo, you lost like 70 pounds, yo.
Yeah, so they hadn't seen me since then. So they just remember what I used to look like. And I go back and everyone's like, whoa, man, you lost a lot of weight. What happened? But it felt good to be back. And at the time, I'll tell you this, and all you surgeons, you're not going to like it. But, you know, I just got to tell you. When I went back, I still had to do a duodenostomy in. I still had the feeding tube in. We weren't using it, but I still had a feeding tube in. And I just, you know, I wrapped it, you know, banded it together, safety pinned it on my shirt, put the dress shirt over it, just so I could get back to work. And, you know, a lot of people be like, well, why did you take that risk? Like, you could have pulled it out. Like, you know, that's super risky. Why would you even try to find a way? And at that point, I'd been at home for 6 months. So, yeah, I wasn't in the hospital, but it still felt like I was trapped. It was like going from the prison to the halfway house. That's what being at home was. I couldn't do anything still. I still didn't have full autonomy. So getting back to work, that was my taste of that. That was my taste of my life is returning to as normal as it can be. And so, you know, when you're dealing with patients, when you're a caregiver, there are going to be things that they suggest as a patient that don't make sense. So, oh, that might be a little risky. But it's really the patient trying to find their autonomy again, trying to find their freedom again. So they're going to want to drive earlier than normal. They're going to want to go to the gym. They're going to do all these things. And sometimes you just have to go with the flow.
And I think a lot of times we've never been in that. Well, not a lot of times. We've never been in that situation before. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy for us to be like, well, why can't this person understand X? Or why can't they understand A? It's not that they're being nonsensical about things, but I get that emotional, psychological component that they just can't see.
Yeah. And mind you, we're talking about residency. We're not even talking about actual job. We're talking residency still.
Yeah.
And I still had like ICU rotation to complete. Like I still had, you know, the ones I missed that I had to make up. But it was like, I needed to be back. I needed to feel, you know, valuable. I needed to feel like I was able to do the things I was doing before all of this happened. And so I was like, yo, I've been out long enough. February, I'm going back. It was different. People looked at it different. There was a lot of empathy given. So, you know, it was great. It was just great to be back and to be missed and to, you know, get back to using my knowledge. Things are going normal. I'm driving to work. Like things are starting to feel right. So, you know, everything is looking good. And then let's fast forward to the graduation week. I have a small bowel ileus because I just started having this massive cramping. Hey, we got to go to the hospital because I don't know what's going on. I'm getting distended. And so when I went there, one of my former residents, she was a nocturnist at Piedmont, Dr. Amber Boyd. She was there and she admitted me. And she was like, yo, why didn't you say anything? Like, what's going on? Like, I'm hearing all this about a resident that, you know, had some surgeries and blah, 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 blah. Then your name pops up. So it was funny running into her. And then they did NG tube. They passed that live, which is awful. Mm-hmm. I think that's about the second worst thing I had done was the NG tube. By far. That's the second worst. First, straight cath. Straight cath by far is the worst. But NG tube while you're awake is a close second. Yeah, because it went up the right, it couldn't get it. And so then they tried again with the left. And you know how big those are. Like we're talking about real NG going up your nostril, down your throat, you're coughing, choking, and all that. And you're sitting there for a week and you can't eat, can't drink anything. You're thirsty all the time. Ice chips don't work. You try to sneak a little Gatorade in there. It don't work. You know, you try to fight to get back to normal. And I did a lot of that. And it taught me a lot about the patient experience and how we can help people understand the mindset so that you're not an adversary of the person you're taking care of. You become their assistant, you become their companion, you become an ally, you know, because a lot of things we do, we try to enforce compliance on people without understanding where the non-compliance is coming from. So we're not really attacking the root of the issue. And I had them all to know, like, you know, you tell me any story, I'll tell you why they're fighting it. You talk to them, they'll tell you why we're fighting it. So
go ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
So that was it. After that, haven't been back since.
So let me ask you a question. And I appreciate you sharing this story at the level of which you shared it. And you know, me kind of shaking my head or putting my head down is not because, it's because I feel everything that you tell me. And I know what it's like to kind of go through that with patients. And I know with you, I feel like I know what you was going through. You know what I'm saying? And so as a surgeon, I'm like, damn, man. Like, I hope we don't have to go back in his belly. But so through this entire process, like, let's wrap it up. But I want to get to, when did you decide that you wanted to do something about your experiences and what led you to creating the Caregiver Sanctuary? Tell us about like that. What happened?
So let's fast forward coronavirus. That's really when it started. When it really kicked off in March, I was working outpatient and people were getting sick left and right at work. And we decided to part ways in April. So I'm sitting there. I hadn't had a vacation in a while, so I looked at it as an extended vacation. And during that time, I got with my mentor and we just started talking about my experience because I had never fully expressed everything that happened. So as we talked about it, I'm telling him the story the same way I'm telling you. And at each stop, I'm saying, well, I did this because I was thinking this. I did that because I was thinking that.
And not to cut you off, I just typed you up and I'm looking at your old picture and I see exactly what you talk about.
Right.
That is a dramatic change.
Yeah.
All right, my bad. Keep going though.
Yeah, so, I'm slim and trim now. But as I'm talking about the story, I'm realizing I'm able to fill the gaps and understand, okay, this is where my mind was at the time. And if I had known that before, the whole process would have gone smoother. And when I realized that, I said, well, there are a lot of people that are caring for someone who's sick and they don't know how to do it effectively. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing the best they can, but they're running into issues. They're having arguments. They're having communication breakdowns. They just can't seem to understand why this person they love is acting in a certain way. And being someone who had lived through that, all the reasons you could possibly have for doing something or not doing something, I know personally. So I said, this has to be the way I can use my story to help other people, because no matter what, we're going to have people we love and they're going to get sick. We can't really avoid that. Whether it's corona, whether it's cancer, whether it's heart disease, kidney disease, Alzheimer's, whatever it may be.
And we might end up being the primary caregiver at one point.
And we might. And at some point, we're going to end up being thrown into a role we weren't prepared for. No one's ever prepared for that. Even physicians, medical staff, we're not prepared for it when it hits us personally. It's different now. When it's your parent, when it's your sibling, when it's your child, it's different now. So seeing that and being able to say, hey, here's where I can help them because I know they're struggling. I know the issues they're facing, like my family issue dealing with me. So if I can give you the play-by-play, if I can give you the perspective so that you understand, okay, this is what they're doing. I don't need to fight this one. I need to just let them have it. They'll get through it.
So what exactly is the caregiver sanctuary then? Is it like, take us through that. What is it then?
So the caregiver sanctuary is really a place of help and support for family caregivers, right? Mm-hmm. That's the primary arching goal. So if you have a spouse, sibling, child, parent, and you're now thrust into a role as primary caregiver, where I come in is I'm counseling you, the caregiver. The patient, they have a whole team of people to care for them. They got family, friends, whatever. But my primary focus right now is to care for the caregivers because no one really knows what they're going through. No one checks on their health, right? And even in the studies, we're seeing that middle-aged caregivers, they're dying at 4 times the rate of their counterparts who aren't caregivers. 4 times is a lot if you're middle-aged. That's really bad when you're getting heart disease more. You're getting cancer more, you're getting more strokes, it's decreasing your life expectancy. So now it's going into physical ramifications.
Manifestations, yeah.
And it's happening from things that can be prevented. And that's when it really hit me. Like, if people just got this information as a caregiver, it will relieve so much of their stress. They'd be able to communicate better, they'd be able to function better, they'll be able to balance caregiving in their personal life a lot better, and they won't neglect themselves. Because we see that a lot. I'm sure you've seen that a lot as a surgeon, where you know which family members are really caring for the patient and who's just there.
Yeah.
And you've probably seen the arguments when decisions had to be made and all these kinds of things that tear a family apart, that tear a marriage apart. And it doesn't have to happen that way. So I'm here to counsel the caregivers and guide them through the process of being a caregiver and give you those steps and say, hey, this is what you're facing. This is what you're battling. Your loved one may be saying this, but this is really what you're dealing with. And this is how you counteract that so that you can get through this a lot better than me and my family did. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it's about. Gotcha. You know, a lot of things in life happen and then they become a warning to others. But sometimes we go through things because there are people coming behind us who can't avoid it. And they need a guide to show them how to navigate that same path a lot better than you did. And I feel like that's the reason I'm alive today, to help those families navigate that process of caring through someone who's sick and recovering and dealing with whatever medical condition they're doing. So it's really counseling for family health caregivers, right? That's really what it's for. I'm providing that counseling I'm providing support in terms of emotional, mental, in terms of hospice care, supplies care, dealing with insurance companies, all the things that you're going to have to learn how to do as a family caregiver. You're going to have to get those meds. You're going to have to get those supplies. You're going to have to find facilities that they can stay in if need be. And we're developing that space where we can have those resources available to help people through that process.
Wow. That's what's up, man. That's
yeah. So
that is amazing. Yeah.
Born out of Corona, out of the pandemic, just sitting there and having to deal and actually face the trauma that I dealt with and didn't know I was dealing with. I didn't even know I was holding on to that trauma. And this is 2020 from 3 years ago. Hmm. I was functioning with trauma. Didn't know.
You just, you're, it sounds like you're trying to get back to normal as much as possible, yeah. But you're masking something that you just have no clue. And it's not until another major event comes that you're right. Kind of forced to look at. And don't let me speak for you. Let me know if I'm talking BS or not. But
no, you're absolutely correct because you're forced to face it now. At the time, there wasn't going outside. There were no trips. I wasn't working at that point. I really had nothing else to do but face that and replay everything and go through all the ups and downs of that journey and say, okay, now I've processed the trauma that I've experienced. Now I'm beyond that. How can I use this to help other people? And that's where the passion came from. And that's when it really felt like a purpose.
Now, how do you
get it wrong?
Now, is this now your primary way of practicing, or are you balancing this with, I'm assuming you're still doing hospitalist internal medicine work?
Yeah. So okay. I'm balancing both, but I'll say this. Caregiver sanctuary and any future projects with patients and their trauma that I'm going to be doing, that's really what my purpose is.
Okay. So this is right. What you really
now, being
want to
a
do.
Doctor, being a physician is great. I love it. I enjoy it. It's given me many opportunities.
Why you said musician?
Physician.
Oh, I thought you said, okay. I was about to say, why you wait till the end to say you a musician?
Oh, no, that okay, was high school. My bad.
Okay. So being a physician is where it's at, but.
It's
your passion,
great, but
your
that's purpose. Not my purpose.
Got you.
Being
got you.
On this planet. You know what I mean? So it's great. This is my purpose, though. And it took nearly dying and coronavirus and 33 years to discover that. So, you know, you can't run from experiences that will lead you to your purpose. Good or bad, they all lead to the reason why you're on this planet. And when I was ready to accept that, and ready to accept that my life had changed and it was going to be different from here on out, that's when it started coming in. And now I feel like I'm living the best life I could possibly live. This is my life now is better than it was back then. But it's that fear of change. It's that fear. It's that uncertainty, right? It's the unknown. It's the loss of having control over your life that can paralyze you from moving forward. So,
yeah, but I'll tell you something right now. I don't envy being in your shoes, but at the same time, I am envious of how you've come out. If you know what I'm talking about. Dude, you've been through the fire. You went through the fire to come out stronger. And that's dope, right? Because now I'm sure you feel like nothing can touch you. Like, dog, you had a duodenal blowout. You probably a risk of having short gut syndrome, a risk of having a resection of your lung. If you could go through all of that, and then on top of that, you know, probably get killed by Corona, you know?
Right. I think that kind of affected my view when I was working and Corona was happening. I was like, I'm not scared of this. Like, I know it's real, but it's like, I had worse, man. Can't really scare me with this one. Like,
and you're not on any residual things from your surgery, right? Like, you're not on any meds?
No, of course. I'm on medication indefinitely. Well, it was GI stromal tumor.
Oh, my man. Well, that's what I was about to say. What was the pathology?
GI stromal tumor.
So GIST. So
rate was 55.
So you got to take Gleevec?
I did. It worked for a year and a half, stopped working, switched to Sutent.
Okay.
But as you know, Gleevec eventually fails in everybody. So,
okay.
I knew that was part of the course.
So you, man, my man, you've been through it.
And yeah, but no, the high mitotic rate was 55, yeah. But it was a normal type.
So. Yeah. So you've been through it and you've come on the other end with more empathy, and it looks like basically fearless now.
Yeah, just a better understanding. And I think that's something that can help everybody, whether, you know, you're a health professional, whether you're just a family member, whether you're a patient. Once you live it, you come with knowledge that isn't taught in school. You know, we're not taught things like this. We're taught diagnosis, treatment.
And compliance.
Yeah. And that's basically it. So certain things you have to live through to be able to say, hey, this is how it goes. This is what you're really dealing with. This is how we can fight these things. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm thankful that it happened, but I don't like that it happened.
Yeah, I get that. And that's where I was saying about the whole envious thing. Like, yo, dog, like you've been through it. I don't know if I want to go through that to learn your lesson. But yeah. The fact that you understand that is something that a lot of people don't get. And that's an enviable position to have that knowledge, to look at your patients who are not taking their meds, or to have someone, you probably have a patient who, you know, if they don't do X, Y, and Z, they probably will die, and they will look at you and say, I don't want to do it. You understand that.
Yeah. And I understand exactly where they're coming from. And when they say that, you know, you can't use fear as motivation. You can't scare someone that's willing to take a consequence. You can't scare them with a consequence anymore. And we try to use that. We try to use fear.
Oh, you're going to die.
And to get compliance.
Yeah, it's not going to work.
And when someone's at the end of it and they're saying, well, I'm going to do this anyway. You know, especially with people who have like diabetes and things like that, where it's like, well, you're already cut off my leg. I don't really care now. Like, I'm going to keep eating these collard greens. I'm going to keep eating this cornbread. Like,
we've seen it. They come through the ED.
Yeah. I already had a BKA. I already had AKA. Like, I mean, what, you can't scare me anymore. I don't care. I'm going to eat what I want to eat. Right. And it's not ignorance. It's just you have to use something different. They're not willing to accept that life change. They're not willing to say, hey, I have to change this aspect because this makes me feel good. And I don't have anything else right now that feels familiar except the soul food. And that's what you're fighting. Right. But, you know, because we're minorities and we're Black, you know, the narrative is going to be, well, they just uneducated. They just ready to die. They don't care nothing about their life. And it's not that. They might have full understanding. Hey, I could die from this.
There's a level of nuance. There's a level of nuance that we're not afforded. If you know that, I think that's what you get. There's a level of complexity that is not afforded. Like, oh, there's no way this person can think complex about this. Yeah.
And that's when you have to get outside of using fear. Like, oh, well, if you do this, your kidney's going to shut down. Well, okay. I'm still going to eat what I want. I got some red velvet cake at home. I'm going to eat it still because it makes me feel great. It makes me feel normal. You took my leg. I got to look at that every day. I got to deal with that. I want to do things that make me feel normal. I'm not ready to accept this change. I'm not ready to move on from something I've enjoyed for 40 or 50 years of my life. And that's the crux of what we're dealing with, you know, certain diseases. Mm-hmm. That's what you're fighting, you know? So it's just knowing that can kind of help foster starting that conversation of saying, okay, well, if that's your fear, let's find ways to manage your sugar intake. Let's find foods that you can have. Let's work together so that you feel more comfortable with these changes. Because the more you try to force it, the more you're going to resist.
You know, I see you, for some reason, I feel like you should be like a speaker for every resident or every intern who's about to come in so that they understand what it's like, you know, to be on top of the world 1 minute and then, you know, the next minute to be a patient and what it's like to go through that, the mindset change, the psychology, all of those things that you mentioned so that you can better prepare yourself to understand what it's like to be a patient and what they go through. Like, I feel like somehow, like, it should be like required video that people watch, like right before they start their intern year. That's where I feel like it is with you, man. Cause this was really dope, man. Like, this perspective that you gave me is something that is, something I wasn't expecting. And when I heard your show, I wanted to get in more in depth because there's certain things that you shared here that I wanted to ask you. And now that you've kind of told me, I was like, I get what you're saying now 100%, you know, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that, brother. This was dope, man. Listen, people want to get in contact with you or people want to find out more about the Caregiver Sanctuary. Tell us all that, how we do that.
Right. So, you can start with the Caregiver Sanctuary page. So that's www.thecaregiversanctuary.com. That's when you can find out what I'm doing over there in terms of counseling for the caregivers. All the information is there on my social media, on my Instagram. It's Memoirs of a Patient, where I have a lot of content coming out about the things I'm going through, medications I'm taking, side effects, supplements, all those things daily that I'm dealing with, and more information about caregivers, caregiver support, and trauma support of medical PTSD. So Memoirs of a Patient on Instagram. Facebook is facebook.com/JamalRashad for my Facebook page, where I have all that information there. So that's pretty much it. So that's where you can find me. It's all public, so you can search it. You don't have to worry about, oh, I got to wait for you to be added. All the stuff is there. I'll have videos. All that's going to be up there. So check me out. If you know anyone that's dealing with these sorts of issues, caring for someone with COVID, Alzheimer's, end-stage renal, whatever it may be, just send them to my stuff, man. I have a lot of information to share, a lot of people that need the help and need to be found so that we can give them that help.
And there it is, Dr. Jamal, from the top of the hill to literally an X-lap.
Bottom.
To back on the top and dragging a whole bunch of people with him, man. This was dope.
Yeah, man.
Appreciate everything that you're doing. You blessed. And listen, man, I really appreciate you coming on Docs Outside the Box. Thank you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. And sorry to all the surgeons out there, man. I know y'all couldn't believe all that stuff, man. But hey, you know, y'all had some patients like me before, and you'll understand in the future when you see them.
Oh, we got you. We got it, man.
All righty.